Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The murder of six people in Isla Vista, California, 2 weeks ago follows a pattern that has become tragically familiar. A lone gunman with a cache of weapons and a grudge goes on a rampage, randomly killing innocent people before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The tragedy reignited a national debate about mental illness, violence, and easy access to guns, the latter painfully questioned by Richard Martinez. His son, Christopher, was among the victims.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live?
Politicians, analysts, and Facebook posts tell us that these massacres could be prevented with an improved mental health care system. Then mentally unstable people like Elliot Roger could be identified and stopped before buying guns. Our guest, Richard A. Friedman, disagrees. He's professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at the Weill Cornell Medical College. His op-ed, Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers, appeared in the New York Times. Dr. Friedman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you do not think that improving our mental health care system would prevent these mass shootings. Why not?
Well, I think the reason is that, first of all, it's important to realize these are extremely rare events. So it's a bit like looking for a needle in a haystack. They account for about 0.1% of all homicides in the United States. That's the first thing. The second is most of these people, with the exception of a few of them, tend to avoid the mental health system entirely. They're isolated, angry, paranoid, usually young men who avoid the mental health system. That's not true of Elliot Roger, who had contact with the mental health system, which brings up the third point, which is our ability to determine and predict who's likely to be violent, even when we see them and evaluate them, is no better than chance. In other words, with the current state of science and epidemiology, we're not actually very good at predicting who's likely to be violent for a couple of reasons. One is people can withhold that information. If they're psychopathic, they can lie, they can be in treatment, they can be in evaluation, and simply never tell anybody. And the other is that even though we know what some of the risk factors for violence are, the vast majority of people who actually have that profile, for example, being a young male who's psychotic and angry and abusing drugs, those are very powerful risk factors for violence. Most people who have those risk factors in that profile will never be violent.
And to your second point, in the case of Elliot Roger, his mother did call the police in Isla Vista, who visited him, and he was
right.
able to assure them that he was, you know, just fine. Polite, I think the police said. Is this characteristic of a psychotic or a sociopathic personality?
It's more characteristic of someone who's sociopathic or antisocial. Those are synonymous, meaning somebody who basically is in control, knows exactly what they're going to do, and is planning and scheming something terrible and does everything possible to conceal it. I mean, that said, I think it's important to make the point that, I mean, I believe that we should do everything possible to identify people who are likely to be violent in advance, meaning, you know, the public should be educated to look for the warning signs. I mean, in this case, there were several. He posted videos. He was odd. He made many people along the way during his life worry about him. And in recent months, you know, even his mother went to the police. I would say, given that, it's remarkable that the police just showed up at the door and took his report, a snapshot of him at that one moment, as evidence that everything was okay, against the mother's concern that he was somebody who was at risk. Of course, it might flood the system with false alarms, which is probably what will happen. But if the public is educated to lower the bar, in a sense, to, you know, report to friends, family, and the authorities, anybody that they think is at risk, which is what some people are arguing, you know, it may be helpful.
You mentioned right off the top that a very small percentage of mentally ill people are violent. Is there any
right.
evidence that psychiatric treatment for violently mental ill people would help if they were identified?
Absolutely. In fact, there's very good evidence that if you treat people who have the mental illnesses that are associated with violence, the violence is actually linked to the illness. And once they're treated and they're better and they improve, the risk of violence drops dramatically. So just so your listeners can understand, 4% of all homicide and violence in this country can be attributed to the mentally ill. That means 96% of all violence in this country is perpetrated by normal people. 96%. So it's a tiny amount of violence that gets an enormous amount of press attention. Of course, a mass killer is a horrifying event, which, like a plane crash, gets enormous media attention, and it tends to, you know, warp our sense of risk. Elliot Rodger is of those 0.1% of killers who are responsible for 0.1% of all violence in the United States. That's a tiny, tiny number.
How about other factors, not just psychiatric illnesses, but you point out that drug and alcohol abuse are even more powerful risk factors for violence.
Yes. I think it would surprise most people who are listening to know that somebody who abuses drugs or alcohol, for example, an intoxicated businessman in a suit walking down the street, is far more dangerous and more likely to assault you than a muttering, psychotic young man lying in the street. Drugs and alcohol raise the risk of violence nearly 7 times the risk of people who don't have a mental illness and don't use drugs.
Well, there are laws in place that do prevent or make it more difficult for diagnosed psychotics or mentally ill, prone to violence individuals from buying guns. What are those laws?
Well, we have several of them, and then they're well-intentioned. For example, in New York, we have the SAFE Act, which, you know, requires clinicians to report to the state authorities anybody who they feel clinically is at risk of being violent, so that if they try to purchase a gun, they'll be prevented from purchasing a gun. The problem is, of course, one, we're not very good at predicting who is risky. Two, it may have the unintended effect of driving people away from mental health treatment, because if they're worried they're going to be reported and be in a database, they may just shun us entirely. The third problem is, of course, that, you know, people can buy guns or obtain guns illegally, and the country is awash in unregistered illegal guns. We probably have 500,000 of them floating around. So even if you can turn off the spigot, even if you had reasonable gun control, there'd still be an enormous pool of weapons that would be available, you know, to obtain illegally.
Dr. Richard A. Friedman is with us. He's professor of clinical psychiatry at Cornell Medical College. And we're talking about why doctors can't identify killers, even those mentally ill people who might be prone to violence. So in the case of Elliot Rodgers, he had not been institutionalized or involuntarily hospitalized. He had been prescribed, I believe, with an antipsychotic drug that is associated with treating schizophrenia. The question here is, would lowering the threshold for involuntary psychiatric treatment be effective in preventing mass killings?
Probably not, largely because these people never reach our offices or our emergency rooms in the first place in order to be evaluated and potentially involuntarily treated. They avoid us. We might succeed, and I actually am in favor of lowering the threshold. Currently, the threshold is set at, you know, if somebody is imminently at risk of hurting themselves or others, meaning, you know, they have a plan, they've issued a threat, you can involuntarily treat them. To many people, that seems like, you know, the acting, you know, too late. Why must we require imminent threat? Isn't preponderance of risk reasonable enough in order to treat people against their will, so long as they're ill and they lack judgment to see that they're sick and at risk? And I think the answer is it's reasonable to lower the threshold. Again, the risk might be that if people realize that they're likely, more likely to be involuntarily treated, they might not show up for evaluation in the first place, because a lot of people are afraid of being involuntarily treated. A lot of patients will come into the office in the emergency room and say things like, you know, in response to a question, are you thinking about hurting yourself or hurting someone else? They may say, you know, I really don't know that I want to tell you that because you're going to hospitalize me if I tell you the answer. That happens all the time. So we're up against that. But again, I don't think These things may have an effect on the margins of lowering the risk of violence for the mentally ill, which is actually a very small contributor to violence overall in the country. I think it will have almost no impact on mass killing. What might have an impact on mass killing is to do a public education campaign so that everybody is involved in identifying risk factors, and friends and family, you know, warn appropriate authorities that, you know, somebody seems odd or at risk and they're worried because they're issuing threats, they're acting in a very odd, frightening way. That may have an effect. I think, you know, as a society, we probably should be educating people to recognize these risk factors.
I'm wondering, Dr. Friedman, with such small prospects for making a difference, why do you think this is a topic of conversation over and over again, that we can somehow identify people who have the potential for risk, and therefore, if we stop them, we stop the violence?
Because it's a natural impulse to believe that, you know, something which is so horrifying, in hindsight, we learn about their behavior in hindsight, and we see that there were warning signs, things that, you know, in the light of day now appear to have put the person at risk. So we think, why couldn't we have stopped this? To my mind, you know, the problem is that, you know, we have an enormous amount of violence in this country that is related to guns. If you think about the fact that 96% of all homicide in this country is carried out by normal people, the majority of whom are actually using guns to do this, I think focusing on the mentally ill gives people the sense that, you know, there's a relatively small group of very scary people out there that contain the risk so that they feel safer, whereas actually, statistically, the risk is all around us. So it psychologically provides an effect to make us feel a bit safer, to think that all the risk, all the danger is being expressed by a very small population in this country.
So what I'm hearing here is mentally ill people, because they have access to gun, therein lies the danger.
No, I would say normal people who have access to guns, therein lies the danger. Because if the vast majority of violence in this country is carried out by normal people in the grip of everyday emotion who happen to have access to a gun, you know, in the old days, a dispute or an argument, you hear this all the time, would end up in a fist fight. Someone would get slapped, someone would get punched, someone would be kicked. At the worst, someone would be stabbed by a knife. Now, the fact that people have such easy, unfettered access to weapons means that what would normally have been a small altercation can turn into a homicide.
We should note, of course, that the first three victims of Elliot Rodger were indeed knifed to death.
Yes.
Dr. Friedman, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard A. Friedman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at the Weill Cornell Medical Center. You'll find a link to read his op-ed, Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers, at wordofmouthradio.org. After the break, we're going to continue to challenge convention with the eye to the news cycle's wackiest reporters, the weathermen. An argument for TV meteorologists to get serious. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the White House rolled out its media strategy for a report on climate change last month, among its targets were television weathercasters. TV meteorologists are prone to goofy props, trading jovial barbs with anchors, and reporting in slickers during driving storms. Still, they are consulted and followed as trustworthy soothsayers. New York University education professor Jonathan Zimmerman wrote an op-ed proposing that they sober up and start talking about climate change. And he's on the line with more. Jonathan Zimmerman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, a little history on the weathercaster that you dug up on American television. Who were the earliest weathermen? And they pretty much were men then.
Yeah, the earliest weathermen were largely veterans of World War II, which makes sense if you think about two things. First of all, during the war, weathercasting was extremely important, right? You weren't going to invade Normandy or Okinawa unless you knew you were going to have the right kind of day. Secondly, it's in the late 1940s that television starts to become ubiquitous. So it does make sense that in the late 40s, the first people, like you said, men, who gave the weather on TV were mostly veterans of the Second World War.
And then in the mid-50s, a boom in stations across the country and a surge of competition. Now, how did this affect weather reporting and how has it fared since?
Well, what happened was in 1948, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, put a freeze on the station licensing and lifted it 4 years later. And so by that time, there are millions of more televisions. And what happens is there's a kind of feeding frenzy where cities that formerly only had one station could have two, three, or even four. So they're all competing with each other. And one way they do that is by, well, making the weather entertaining. Spicing up the weather reports. So you had weather given by puppets, and you had weather given in rhyme. And we shouldn't forget about the so-called weather girls. That was another gimmick, is you'd get a nice-looking younger woman in form-fitting clothing, and she would be a weather girl. So Raquel Welch, who you might remember as a kind of sex symbol from the 60s and 70s, she actually got her start as Raquel Tejeda. Who was she? She was the sun-up weather girl in San Diego. Obviously not a meteorologist, but somebody that the stations were using to try to get more eyeballs for their weather reports.
Weathercasters now present more professionally. You know, we get Doppler radar forecasts, elaborate storm center graphics. So what, Jonathan Zimmerman, is your complaint about today's TV weathercasters?
Well, my complaint is less with the weathercasters than with the culture of weathercasting. That is the format that we use. I think especially since the 1970s and the introduction of the so-called news team, the weathercasters have been cast as, well, jokesters. It's not coincidental that David Letterman got his start as a weatherman. So have several other comics and TV personalities. And the weather people are supposed to be these kind of jocular figures, very silly, who engage in a lot of idle banter. And the problem with that is, thanks to global climate change, weather has become a hugely serious matter. And so I would argue that the culture of weather reporting is inconsistent with, well, the science of weather.
Does one have to be a trained meteorologist to forecast the weather as a weathercaster?
You don't, but I should say that increasingly they are. You know, the American Meteorological Society gives a certificate to weathercasters who show, a certain kind of knowledge and background, and most of them haven't, as opposed to weathercasters in the past.
Does that society have an official policy on climate change?
Well, the society has made an official statement on climate change, which is that it has been changing, especially over the past 50 years, quite starkly, and that human activity is responsible for it. So the AMS, the Meteorological Society, is absolutely crystal clear on those facts, which, by the way, are facts shared by almost every credible scientist who studies this matter.
So given that the job of today's weathercasters is to kind of, you know, liven things up, would a stern warning about climate change actually be effective?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I should tell you that there are some weathercasters who, especially during times of so-called weather crisis like hurricanes, have made reference to this. But I think the answer to your question is that, again, it would require a change in the way that we think about weather journalism. This isn't funny. I mean, there's, you know, it's a hugely serious matter. Would it take some time for viewers to adjust? I think that it would. But I think the time to start that change is now.
Well, Jonathan Zimmerman, I'm trying to imagine what this would sound like. So you get your, there's a tornado coming. And there have been an increase in tornadoes because the planet is warming. I mean, how does an improved, more sober weathercast sound to you?
Well, I think it sounds very different from what we hear. And I think that's precisely why we're going to need a kind of culture shift in how we think about the presentation of these issues. I should tell you, in the early 2000s, when some weathercasters started to discuss this subject, news directors often shot them down and said, listen, people want happy news from the weathercaster. Even if it's going to be rain tomorrow, they want you to present it in a happy idiom. Look, I'm not suggesting that every single night we have to have, you know, a new report about human-made climate change. But I do think that people need to think about the connections between what they're feeling and witnessing and the science of climate change. Indeed, that was President Obama's point when he met with the weathercasters. He said, you know, we know things are happening right now affecting all of our lives because of human-made climate change. And it does seem that the person who's charged with presenting the weather should have a role, not the only role, in reminding us of that.
Well, Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history and education at NYU. His book on the global history of sex education will be published next spring, but we found his op-ed proposing that TV meteorologists get serious about climate change in the Baltimore Sun. You can find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Fall again, shiver in my bones just thinking about the weather.
All right, Philadelphia. Yes, it's cold, and I'm AccuWeather.com's meteorologist Jim Kosick, and I want no part of this stinking air mass, to be honest with you. I love the warmth. I'm a day person.
Shiver in my bones just thinking about the weather. A quiver in my voice as I cry.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard an argument for weathercasters to drop the props and report with more gravity on climate change. Our next guest, Joe Cione, is dead serious when it comes to weather. He's a scientist with the Hurricane Research Division at NOAA's Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory. When sane people are scrambling to get out of the way of a hurricane, Joe is the guy who's flying straight into it. This summer, he hopes to deploy a new tool that could drastically increase our understanding of how hurricanes develop, a weather drone. Producer Taylor Quimby caught up with Joe to get some details.
Joe, tell me a little bit about these drones that you're going to be sending into hurricanes. What do they look like, and I guess what kind of data are they collecting?
Okay, they are 7 pounds, so they're small, and about a 4-foot wingspan. We deploy them from our manned aircraft, which are called P-3 Orions.
And those fly over the storm?
No, we fly through the storm, but we don't fly very low. We fly typically in a hurricane 10,000 feet, sometimes 5,000 feet high. But we don't like to go lower than that due to the safety risks involved, obviously, in a hurricane. The existing way we measure now is we drop something called GPS drop zones.
Mm-hmm.
You could sort of think of it as a straw, sort of. It falls from the bottom of the aircraft, and it samples pressure, temperature, winds, and moisture as it goes down and until it hits the ocean surface. So that's okay. That works. That's our existing technology. The difference is that if we use these Coyote unmanned aircraft that I just described, comes out in a similar fashion from the P-3. We launch it through a tube, and then the wings sprout, and within 30 seconds it's airborne. We command and control it from the aircraft. We can command and control it actually from anywhere. We can do it thousands of miles away. But it measures the same quantities, pressure, temperature, winds, and humidity, but it stays up for a couple hours.
So it can basically fly a circle through the hurricane.
Well, it can do anything we tell it to do. And, well, within reason. You can't go against the winds because we essentially have to fly with the currents of the winds because it's just not powerful enough to overtake the winds. But it can go up, down, sideways, and it stays up for hours. It's sort of a movie versus a snapshot.
So they must be pretty durable, I would think, to hold up in a hurricane.
This is a demo project. We have never done this before. We are very hopeful that it will survive, but we can't guarantee that it will. So beyond the science that we want to do, it's also just an engineering effort to make sure that these can, in fact, survive under the high wind conditions that we will expose them to.
I would think they're pretty costly, too, so the stakes are kind of high.
Well, with anything that's sort of one-off, onesies, twosies, you know, not in production mode, the costs are higher than they would be. But I think economically these will be a much better value than the drop zones because of what I just described as sort of a data per minute. You know, we're looking at how much data we can get. So if we can get hours and hours of data versus a few minutes of something that, you know, the drop zones are not cheap to begin with. I think that this is actually not only going to make sense from a science standpoint, but it's going to make sense economically. Sure, at this point, if you actually get down to the dollars per unit it's expensive, but the expense goes into operations of it, testing of it, making sure that the engineering is indeed correct. This is actually a good example of leveraging military assets. These were originally designed by the Navy, and they use P-3s for sub-hunting. And through the contacts that I've had and working, collaborating with different partners, we hear a lot of stories where, you know, government gets slammed a little bit. But this is a great example of interacting and then transitioning, you know, military technologies to the civilian sector that hopefully we think can improve our understanding, but also save lives and protect property.
You know, when I think about hurricane forecasts, I think, you know, we've obviously come a long way in the past couple decades. So I guess what sort of storm scenarios do you think we could really improve upon at this point?
Actually, that's really only partially true, your statement. We've, over the last 35 years, we've gotten markedly better at what we call storm track, basically where the storm is going to go.
Yeah, the cone.
Yeah, we've narrowed that cone down. But as far as the intensity, how strong it's going to be, we have made very little strides in the last 35 years. We have not at all conquered the intensity change issue. In fact, it's the biggest problem we have, and particularly the risk of rapid intensity change where we can get dramatic swings in intensity over a 24 to 48-hour period. So we are by no means are there. And this platform can really help us because it measures one variable that is very sensitive. The model, computer models, which mimic nature, are telling us that the sensitivity to moisture, atmospheric moisture, is huge. So if the models have, you know, initial conditions with X, you know, 85% relative humidity versus 50 or versus 60 or versus 90, those types of differences can have a huge impact on the future forecasts that the model give. And we have very little what we call thermodynamic data in this boundary layer region, the boundary layer being the lowest few thousand feet in the storm. Right now, we have those sons I told you, those occasional measurements that have wind and that have temperature and moisture. But other than that, we don't have any. So this type of device can really improve the amount. Just forget about improving our understanding, which it can do, I think. But it also, just from a base standpoint, give us a whole lot more thermodynamic pressure, temperature, winds, and mostly moisture and temperature data that we do not otherwise get.
This might be a little philosophical for a weather question, I guess, but how much more accurate do you think we can really get when it comes to predicting storms? I mean, isn't there a ceiling for how good our forecasting can be?
Yeah, I would agree with that. But to get back to my original point, if your bar is laying on the ground, not even off the ground, or maybe a couple inches off the ground, you've got a long way to go before you can't hurdle it. And I think we've got a long way to go before we get to the point where chaos theory kicks in. I do think that you do bring up a valid point. I mean, weather is generally pretty chaotic. But I think that we have, the next 10 to 15 years, the computer models are advanced enough. The computing, the computers to do these calculations are advanced enough. We have these new technologies like the one we're discussing here today on your show, allowing us to target these data void regions. And I think our understanding will jump.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us, and best of luck with the project.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
That was Word of Mouth's own Taylor Quimby speaking with Joe Cione, a scientist with the Hurricane Research Division at NOAA's Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory. There are links to pictures and more on NOAA's new hurricane drone at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is easy to write off product placement as a cheesy, distasteful form of advertising. While that's often the case, a handful of product tie-ins have gone even further to influence consumers and even make headlines, like this classic TV moment, which has been imitated and parodied ever since. And that is a clip from the 2004 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show when the media mogul gave every single person in the audience a free car. The tie-in was featured in Ad Age's recent list of the top 10 product placements of the past 10 years. Ad Age staff writer Michael Sebastian co-wrote the article and joins us with more. Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before you did any research for this list, could you remember which kind of car Oprah gave away that day?
No, absolutely not.
I thought it was a Cadillac. It was a Pontiac.
Yeah, Pontiac. It was the G6, which I believe has been discontinued.
So why do you think that moment, if not the car, has stayed with us, while so many other product tie-ins have been forgotten almost instantly?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, it comes from Oprah Winfrey, who, you know, herself is such a force in the media and in culture. So that's an important part of it. But also, I mean, it had such legs. It moved so much. I mean, it was parodied on Saturday Night Live. I feel like, you know, there's probably a lot of people who may not have seen the original version that you just played, but they certainly saw the parody of it, or they saw some version of it that really resonated with them.
Another car-related product placement that made your list, the blockbuster Transformers films. Remind us.
Yeah, so Transformers, the franchise, had teamed up with GM, and you know, as one executive in the show business community told me that basically the first Transformers movie is just a 2-hour long commercial for the Chevy Camaro, which is a cynical but interesting way of looking at it.
Something I did not realize until I read your article, that not all product placements involve financial transactions. What's behind them?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Often a product placement will involve a trade. We see a lot of that, as a matter of fact. So, for instance, a movie studio might need an airplane or an airport hangar or an airport area to film in. And instead of going through the whole rigmarole of figuring out how to do that, they might reach out to an airline, say an American Airlines or a Southwest Airlines, and say, hey, can we use your airplane, use your hangar, use your space in an airport? And in exchange for that, your branding can be in the movie.
I'd like to play a clip from the trailer for the 2009 film Up in the Air, starring George Clooney. He was the ultimate frequent flyer.
Last year, I spent 322 days on the road. I flew 350,000 miles. The moon is 250. All the things you probably hate about traveling are warm reminders that I am home.
Welcome back, Mr. Bingham.
Now, listeners can't see this, but may remember that trailer was plastered with American Airlines branding. We tend to think of product placement as pretty cheesy, but Up in the Air was an Oscar-winning, critically acclaimed film. How did it transcend the shill label?
Great question, and I think that it was so organic, which is a word that marketers love to use when it comes to this kind of thing. I mean, if it hadn't been an actual airline, one that exists, I mean, if they had gone ahead and made a fake airline, I think that it would have been distracting. You know, people see a movie like this that was really based in realism. I mean, Up in the Air came out at a time when people were being laid off, and it was about a layoff expert. And it would have been distracting if it hadn't been an airline that they had flown with.
On the other side of the divide, there's the 2010 made-for-TV movie called Secrets of the Mountain. Why did this one make your list?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because this was a partnership with Walmart and Procter & Gamble, and it was almost a throwback to some of the kind of soap operas that we would have seen, I mean, even going back to the 50s, 60s, something like that. And this aired on NBC, and this was designed to draw consumers to buy P&G products at Walmart. And, I mean, for their time slot, it drew a pretty good audience. And, you know, this is like considered the holy grail of branded entertainment.
So how did it come off? Was it a knock you over the head with product placement kind of movie?
You know, not as bad as one would suspect, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, there was certainly P&G products within there, but it wasn't as if it was, you know, like that scene from Wayne's World where Wayne holds up the pizza box with a grin.
Well, that is a really funny one. It's not always subtle. The Wayne's World movie was pretty hilarious in making fun of product placement while doing it overtly. And in 2012, the Colbert Report did the same thing. Here's a clip from a nearly 7-minute segment about Wheat Thins.
I would love to pour this whole box in my mouth right now. But the memo clearly states that we can't show overconsumption. That is a brand don't. You see, the serving size for Wheat Thins is 16 crackers. So as delicious as they are, I shouldn't eat more than 16. And also, if they are shown out of the box, like in a bowl, there should only be a max of 16. So remember, everyone, while Wheat Thins is, quote, a snack for anyone who is actively seeking experiences, those experiences do not include the experience of eating 17 crackers. And you know what? That is the way it should be. Because when you think about it, and they have, 16 is the perfect number of Wheat Thins to keep you on the path to and proud of doing what you love to do, no matter what that is. No matter what.
Stephen Colbert there. So, Michael Sebastian, was that a win for Wheat Thins, even though its brand strategy is clearly being made fun of?
It was definitely a win. I mean, you don't go on the Colbert Report or team up with Stephen Colbert unless you have a sense of humor, or at least think you have a sense of humor. And I think that what we saw here was, you know, something that would appeal to not only his audience, but also the next level, so to speak, of product placement, which is this whole idea of an overt wink and nod to the camera and even making fun of it. But guess what? The message got across.
Here is an item on your list that had a real functional value. Now, that was the partnership between AT&T and American Idol. Why does that rate?
You know, that rates as maybe one of the most important product placements because it, as at least one executive in the ad industry told me, taught America how to text message. I mean, obviously, how many people text message now? Prior to that partnership, you know, it wasn't something that was ubiquitous in the way that it is today. So, I mean, that product placement and partnership caused a real kind of cultural shift. I mean, you could argue that it was going to happen anyway, but this certainly sped it along.
You write, Michael, that product placement actually saved a couple of television shows from being canceled. How did that happen?
In the case that we're talking about, it's both Chuck and Community, and teamed up with Subway, which ended up underwriting the costs of the production in exchange for some serious product placement within the two shows.
Here's a clip from the third season of Community. This is after Subway stepped in and saved the show from being canceled.
Any business operating for profit on Greendale's campus must be at least 51% owned by a registered Greendale student.
That's too bad, Dean. I don't recall seeing Subway in my premenopausal post-feminist experiential marketing class.
Actually, I'm on the wait list for the pre-men post-fem X mark.
Who are you?
Gang, meet Greendale's newest student, Subway.
Your name is Subway.
Yep.
Okay. Pretty overt. Seems like the original idea around product placement was to integrate advertising into programming so that viewers wouldn't really notice that they were being pitched. But the trend I'm seeing is making product placement pretty obvious and pretty funny rather than, you know, the subconscious approach. Is that what you're seeing too?
To some extent. I think that you nailed the one part about kind of that sense of humor. And I think for a show like Community, the audience would have rejected it if they hadn't taken that approach. But on the other hand, another big trend that we're seeing is sort of brands working with showrunners, producers, Hollywood execs at the ground level, meaning when they're developing a series or when they're sitting down to write an episode, they're talking about not only how they can work the product into the show, but how they can work kind of the spirit of the product or the spirit of the brand into a show at the very start. Now, you won't get a lot of studios talking at length about this because I think there's a certain dark art quality to it. But at the same time, this is really kind of the emerging trend in this space.
Well, Michael Sebastian, watching the trends as a staff writer at Ad Age, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael co-wrote the top 10 product placements of the last 10 years list. You can see it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Before a company can benefit from advertising methods like product placement, it must first settle on what may be the most important aspect of building a brand. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible reports on the tricky business of naming a business.
This is Blueprint. I'm Roman Mars.
No. This is an ear for design. I'm Roman Mars. Ugh. This is 99% invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Now that's nice.
The name is important.
It's the first thing, the tip of the spear, with any product you use or buy or see.
And you're bombarded by thousands of names every day.
The name of this producer is Avery Truffleman.
And naming companies, as in companies that name things, are responsible for many of the proper nouns that you remember.
Naming is just this weird little area, and really, there's so few naming companies. There's like 20.
And Laurel founded one of them.
My name is Laurel Sutton. I'm one of the co-founders of Catchword. We're a naming firm here in the Bay Area.
She and her team have worked on everything. A line of yogurts for Chobani, the Palm Prix, Gap's customer rewards program. They have named, as they put it, everything except a car.
You might think, hey, I named my dog or my kids or my band or my blog. It's not too hard. But there are a number of things to consider when designing a name.
Naming companies don't just make up names. They also check what names are available for URLs and for trademarks, and they see which names mean bad things in other languages.
But more than anything else, Laurel and her team at Catchword just produce a ton of names.
Over 2,000 names per client.
And they come up with names across the naming spectrum.
Okay, so we always draw a spectrum. Because we're talking about language, it's always a spectrum.
So at one end of the spectrum, you have descriptive names.
And those are names that absolutely just describe what the thing is. Classic example, Raisin Bran.
Benefits of descriptive names. They are self-explanatory.
That's what that stuff is, right? It's a box, it's bran, and it has raisins in it. Shredded wheat. That's what that is. It's wheat and it's been shredded.
Drawbacks to descriptive names? They are hard to own.
Normally, you can't trademark names like this. In fact, Raisin Bran and Shredded Wheat are not trademarks. Anybody can have a cereal and call it Raisin Bran or Shredded Wheat.
So a lot of descriptive names tend to get modified.
International Business Machines, pretty darn descriptive. Over time, they've condensed that to IBM.
The other big drawback is that descriptive names can be limiting.
If you remember, there were companies called things like e-stamps. Right? If you ever want to do anything but sell electronic stamps, you're screwed.
On the other end of the spectrum, you've got so-called arbitrary names.
Apple is a great example of that. It doesn't tell you anything about what they do.
Which allows for flexibility.
They used to just make computers. Now they do media. They could do anything under that. I mean, they could make cars.
The benefits of arbitrary names. They're easy to trademark, easy to get the domain name for, and usually good in languages around the world.
Drawback, they are hard to market.
You have to explain them to people. You know, you got to put a lot of money behind these kinds of names to tell people what they mean.
Remember when the iPad was about to come out? Everyone thought it was the silliest name. You heard all kinds of sanitary napkin jokes. But now, through sheer force of will and advertising dollars, you don't think twice about it.
Arbitrary names can also just be completely made up.
Like Kodak has absolutely no meaning. They only chose it because that great hard K sound is very acoustically relevant, that is, it really cuts through. We tend to say that things that start with that hard K sound are strong.
Right, okay, so you've got descriptive on one end of the spectrum and arbitrary on the other, and most names fall somewhere in between the two, and Laurel calls all these names in the middle suggestive names.
They're not exactly arbitrary, and they're not exactly descriptive, like Microsoft.
Microsoft, software for microcomputers. Right? It kind of says what it does, but not really, because it's those two words that are smushed together like that.
And you wouldn't think it, but suggestive names are really difficult to create.
Because you want them to have meaning. A lot of them are taken.
Taken for domain names and trademarks. But okay, let's be honest. Money talks.
The long and short of it is this.
If you've got enough money, basically the name could be anything.
That's Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.
Thank you for joining us today as we poked at some habitual ways of thinking and doing things. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most interesting and thought-provoking bits of information get passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.